is Acts chapter 16, verse 22. The crowd joined in the attack against Paul and Silas, and the magistrates ordered them to be stripped and beaten. After they had been severely flogged, they were thrown into prison, and the jailer was commanded to guard them carefully. Upon receiving such orders, he put them in the inner cell and fastened their feet in the stocks. About midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the other prisoners were listening to them. Suddenly there was such a violent earthquake that the foundations of the prison were shaken. At once all the prison doors flew open and everybody's chains came loose. The jailer woke up, and when he saw the prison doors open, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself because he thought the prisoners had escaped. But Paul shouted, "Don't harm yourself, we are all here." The jailer called for lights, rushed in, and fell trembling before Paul and Silas. He then brought them out and asked, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" They replied, "Believe in the Lord Jesus, and you will be saved, you and your household." Then they spoke the word of the Lord to him and to all the others in his house. At that hour of the night, the jailer took them and washed their wounds. Then immediately he and all his family were baptized. The jailer brought them into his house and set a meal before them. He was filled with joy because he had come to believe in God, he and his whole family.
Mm. Well, welcome to Woody, home of fruit and nuts. We are a slightly odd church, as if you're here for the first time, you'll have noticed. I tell you what's great about this place, though, is you keep on bumping into people who God's impacted their life in a way which has made a profound difference. I think that's come out in all three stories that the girls have shared this morning, as well as, of course, the reading that Annabelle brought to us just now. But I'm not going to use that as my sort of text this morning. I hope you'll forgive me for being just a little bit mischievous, because I owe my text this morning to the British Humanist Association. God bless them. They've just bought up advertising space on the side of a load of London's bendy buses. And here's the text that they got. It's a slogan that they've put on the side of the buses, and it goes like this: "There is probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life." And the plan is that they have that this is going to appear all over London in traffic jam after traffic jam, so that you find yourself in gridlock looking at these magic words. Now, I've got to say a couple of things about this. One is that I actually welcome the initiative. I think it's absolutely brilliant that the BHA are investing in raising the profile of the God question. In fact, I sent them a little email just to thank them for bringing the issue of God to people's attention and for providing an absolute godsend to preachers everywhere. So I welcome it. But the second thing that I have to say is I find the message itself just a trifle bizarre for a couple of reasons. One is that word probably. Did you notice that probably there is no God? They know you can't disprove the existence of God. Richard Dawkins, who's the closest you can get to a professional atheist these days, in a recent debate said this. He said, "I'll concede that you can make a rational case for the existence of God. Though naturally I wouldn't accept it." Naturally. So they're saying God might be there. We might be created by a God who's interested in us and to whom we're accountable. There might be a possibility of finding or losing something in God besides which everything else in your life is secondary. There might be a possibility of glorious, fulfilled life forever, not just for 70 years, but for forever. And of course, if that's true, it's of a momentous significance. So what's the BHA message? They think it's unlikely. 20% chance, maybe? 10% chance if you're really putting it dead low. And then they say, "Now stop worrying and enjoy your life." Now I want you to imagine that you're boarding a plane. There's an announcement that comes on the intercom which says, "There have been reports of a bomb on board the flight today. We've made a cursory examination. We can't immediately find anything. We reckon there is only a 10% chance that the plane will be blown up in mid-flight this afternoon. So stop worrying and enjoy your flights." You know, aren't there just times when probably doesn't quite cut the mustard? A 10% chance of being loved by a creator of the universe and living forever is not much of a basis for saying, fine, I can forget all about it now. I would like to do my darndest to chase this one down, and absolutely no, wouldn't you? Because there's a huge, great big issue. So probably there's no God. Well, actually, of course, that's exactly what I would want to part company with our humanist friends, because I think there's a wealth of evidence that points to the reality of God. If you were happy to listen to me rattling on until tea time, and I know that you aren't, so don't worry too much. I would love to present some of the evidence of it. The fact that anything is there in this world at all. The inconceivably exact conditions that scientists tell us have to be operative in the universe in order for it to exist at all after the Big Bang. If you were to put the mathematics of that, it's a one in something with umpteen noughts on the end of it chance that all of the conditions would be exact enough for a universe to exist. But it does. There's the order that you find in nature without which science would be impossible. And you might be saying, oh yes, but that's because of evolution. But it isn't just living nature that's got that order in it. It's everything, so evolution can't begin to explain it. There's our own humanity as people that are capable of responsible choice. People who've got an awareness of right and wrong. People who've got an ability to reason, the capacity for love, an instinct to worship. People who need a sense of purpose and significance to function properly. And you see, I look at all of that, and it makes perfect sense to me if I'm created by a personal God, and none of it makes a heck of a lot of sense at all if I'm not. If you were to say to me, what's the biggest single evidence for the fact that God is there? I would say, you are. You are. This isn't the day or the time, of course, but if you've been kind enough to come here today, and we really appreciate that, and I know the girls do, even though you think we're all completely crazy and this God stuff is rubbish, I would invite you to check it out. Maybe even more than that. And I'd invite you to do, was it Christine who had this prayer, to try this kind of provisional prayer, God, I want to find out if you're real. That's if you're there, of course, which I'm not assuming for the time being. But if you're real, you'll probably need to help me out on this one and meet me halfway. So please help me to come to know the truth about you if you're there. And why do I expect this to make a difference? Because Jesus said, ask and you receive. Knock and the door will be open to you. He's actually making this promise. So pray that a minute. You've actually got nothing to lose. If Jesus was wrong, you're no worse off than you were before by saying that to God. If he was right, my goodness, this could be exciting, because your search for truth might just take you to some pretty interesting places. So the word probably is the first thing that I want to take issue with. The second thing is, there is a very odd logical connection for me between the first and the second part of the slogan. There's probably no God. Well, if there's no God, there's no creator of the world. There's no purpose for our existence. There's no personal significance in the life of any one of us. There's no basis for moral values. Ultimately, there's no future for anyone. And there actually may not be anyone in this cold, soulless universe who cares about us at all. And we've just got to make the best of it. Frankly, it's not good news. Frankly, if you can make that into good news, you're more creative than I am. If you think about it, the logical response to that situation is the attitude that Bertie Russell, the atheist philosopher, described. He said, I live in an attitude of unyielding despair. And I can respect that. I don't feel particularly envious of it, but I can respect it. In fact, if I thought that we were on our own in the universe, the last thing in the world that I would want was people rubbing it in all the time. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life. I don't think so. I think the slogan probably needs rewriting, something like this. There's probably no God. Now stop thinking about it or you'll be in danger of topping yourself. That's the negative sides. We're here today, and especially Holly and Christine and Kat are here, because we've found that God is wonderfully, gloriously good news. If I can rephrase the question in the film Life of Brian, what did Jesus Christ ever do for us? And there are, I think, four things that come out of the other sermon text that Annabelle read, which is from Acts chapter 16. First of all, God has given us significance. I think of all the stories in the Bible about people who are baptized, the one that we read is my absolute favorite. There are accounts of hundreds of people being baptized. There are accounts of even thousands of people being baptized all at one go. But this is the story of one man, and actually not a particularly attractive man at that. He was the jailer in the Roman city of Philippi in northern Greece. And I don't know about you, but I imagine this guy as a sweaty, overweight guy with a huge paunch hanging over his trousers, wearing a string vest and covered in not very attractive tattoos. I imagine him as a man with a foul mouth and a minimal personal hygiene. In other words, he may not have been the kind of chap who would be at the top of your dinner party guest list. And yet on the night that the earthquake strikes, his life is turned around. And because each individual person matters to God, he ends up as a central character of the drama of that night. One of the central messages of the Bible is that each of us, you, me, and everybody else, is significant to God. We're created to be loved by him, to know him in a personal way. And because we matter to God, God took the initiative to reach out to us when he sent his son, Jesus Christ, into the world. And as Jesus came and as Jesus died on the cross, as Jesus came back from the dead for us, God was and God is speaking to us a huge truth into every one of our lives. And he's saying, you are not a nobody. You are not a nobody. You matter to me and you're significant to me. Even sweaty, overweight, middle-aged men. I have to tell you, that's a huge encouragement to me. Second thing that God's done for us is he's given us acceptance. Or to use the word that the Bible itself uses, he gives us forgiveness. And you can see that in the life of the jailer. He's thrown Paul into the maximum security cell of the prison. He's probably treated him with considerable brutality. He's not a nice man, but then comes the earthquake and the maximum security jail becomes a zero security jail. Very suddenly, it is an extremely open prison. And that's bad news for the Roman jailer, because the deal that the Roman authorities made with jailers was this. You keep your prisoners or you lose your life. So this is a guy who is in absolute total panic. He's about to top himself. He's about to fall on his sword, thinking that after all, that's a considerably pleasanter way to go than Roman crucifixion, which is looking him, staring him straight in the face at that particular moment. Just before he does this, he realizes that Paul and Silas, his prisoners, have deliberately stayed put and they haven't escaped. And he shouts out something like, what have I got to do to get my messed up life back in order? That's a rough translation, but that's roughly what it means. And so Paul begins to tell him about Jesus, about the cross, about forgiveness, about making a new start in God. That in the death of Jesus Christ, God took the responsibility for our mess. That he died with us and for us. That he carried the can for the wrong in each one of us so that we could be forgiven and start fresh. And of course, that's a truth that baptism itself shouts from the rooftops, because it says, Jesus Christ, the Son of God, died for me and I can be washed clean. I can be forgiven, I can be accepted, I can be welcomed, and I can be loved unconditionally. It's a fantastic thing. So the jailer is baptized, his past is washed clean. The families see what's happening to this guy and they like what they see. So they also opt for a new start with Jesus. They're all baptized. This is turning into a very splashy night in the middle of chapter 16 of Acts. And the guy who gets set free from prison on the night of the great earthquake is the guy who ran the place. The guy who gets set free is the guy who ran the place. So let me tell you, it is so good to know that God knows the very worst about me. And through the cross of Jesus, he reaches out to me in forgiveness and acceptance and love. What a gift that is. Third thing, and I'm not too far from the finish here. Take courage, my friends. The third thing is that he gives us power for living. You all have spotted, I think, that what the girls were on about a few minutes ago was not just a new way of looking at life and God and the world, not just a new lot of mental furniture, not just a new set of beliefs. What they were on about was a new power that had invaded their life for good. On the night of the great earthquake, it turned a jailer into a first aider, as this guy tends Paul and Silas's wounds from the beating that they'd had. It made him handle saucepans instead of shackles as he turns cordon bleu chef and head waiter, and he sets a meal in front of his guests and looks after them. And this morose individual, it says, was filled with joy. That's quite a change. That's quite a transformation. And all of us who've come to personal faith in Jesus Christ will be able to say there has been an element of that transformation in our lives. When a person, any person, opens up to a living friendship, living relationship with Jesus Christ, it makes a difference. In a real way, the God who loves us becomes part of us. And although we still have our troubles and our struggles and our ups and downs like everybody else, and don't let anybody tell you otherwise, we aren't on our own anymore. Not ever again. We're living a new life. We're living it as best we know in God's way, letting him call the shots, but more than that, we're living a new life in relationship with him. And that's a powerful thing. And that's why baptism acts out this sense of identification with Christ. The girls will go down into the water, they will go under the water, they'll stay under the water for a couple of minutes or two. No, they won't. then we'll bring them back up. And that symbolizes the fact that we die with Christ. We come to the end of an old way of living. We're buried with him, not thankfully for the 3 days that Jesus spent in the tomb, but we're buried with Christ. And as you come spluttering up out of the pool, spraying everybody left, right, and center, you rise to begin a new life with him. It's a process, this change. It doesn't happen all at once, but knowing Jesus makes a difference. He's given us power for living. And fourthly, he's given us a future. Because this life ain't all there is. You see, we worship someone who's been through death and come back again. And so now we've got a future. The Apostle Paul finds himself at one stage in a prison cell expecting execution. And he writes to his friends in this place called Philippi. And he says, I really don't care, because for me, life is about knowing Christ. And actually, when I die, I'm going to get more of that. I've got a future, and it doesn't actually matter too much what happens to me. And the best thing for us is this, that what God has given to us already in Christ is brilliant, but it is only a beginning. We're going to spend eternity with it getting better. So I have my own bus slogan. It is, if I'm brutally honest, not as catchy as the British Humanist Association's. Frankly, it's a little bit on the long side for the side of a bus, even a bendy bus. It's probably the worst slogan you've ever come across, ever. It's this. It has the advantages of being genuinely good news. And I think it has the advantage of being true. There is a God. He created you. He knows you. Actually, he knows the worst about you. He still loved you enough for his son to die for you. His acceptance and love is a gift. So don't miss it. Don't miss it. That's where the girls are coming from this morning. And indeed myself. And we come now to the point of baptism. Yes, let's go for it. Where's Ruthless?